you know, there's kind of a reporting bias where it's like, I'm thankful for the hardships that I've gone through. But that's because you're happening. Over that's, the
yeah,
hardship. Exactly.
Right, yeah.
That's because yeah. you are done with
because
the
it's
hardship.
In the rear view.
Welcome to the show. We're joined here, as usual, with Mr. Zach Zillner.
Good afternoon, guys. Thanks for listening.
And we are blessed, honored, highly favored to have the brilliant and talented Anna Craig on the show today. Anna, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me, guys.
Anna, not everyone will know who you are. They will after today's show. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what got you into coaching?
Yeah, I am currently an associate performance coach at the University of Texas, athletic performance coach, and I work with women's soccer, women's tennis, and diving. I also work at Collective, which is a private social performance club, and I train a couple of private clients there and teach a few classes. So I span kind of across the private and public sector. And I originally got into coaching. I'll give you the shortened version of this, but I was a student at Texas Tech University and found out about the field of strength and conditioning. And I started to do some research, just honestly Googling who the Texas Tech University strength and conditioning coaches were. And I came across a man's name, which is Benny Wiley, and he was the head football strength coach there. And I thought, if I can do football, I can do anything. I'm just going to jump into the deep end. So I cold emailed him. He said, stop by my office. You know, I think that was probably what he emailed me back. And so I go in there and he's, you know, this big intimidating man. And I don't have a lick of experience in my entire life. And I had played sports, but he interviewed with me and he asked me what I was interested in. And I told him I was a Christian and I was involved in my church. And he said that in that moment, he just felt like he should give me a chance. And I worked with him the next 3 years. He's a strong believer as well, but I worked with him the next 3 years at Texas Tech. And then if you want, I'm just going to complete my story here.
Sure.
I went to the University of Texas to get my master's. I worked with the men's and women's basketball programs there during the first year of my master's. And then Benny actually got hired as the head football strength coach at Texas when I was already there. And so just a full circle of, I guess, meant to be.
Yeah.
And so he hired me on his staff. And I worked with women's soccer from there. And when Mac Brown left, then I was able to get my two other sports, tennis and diving. And here I am.
So how long have you been coaching? You've been coaching soccer, tennis, and diving.
Mm-hmm.
For how long?
Gosh, my first year with soccer was 2013. So it's been 10 years. It might have been 2012, honestly. Maybe I'm losing track. 10 or 11 years. And then tennis and diving have been, shortly after that, they've been 10 years. So it's been it's uncommon in the coaching world to be at a place that long.
So you mentioned something when you were going over your background and your history. You said that you felt like if you could work with football, you could work with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still feel that way?
I feel that way. I felt that way in the moment. And yes, in retrospect, absolutely, because I was a 19-year-old female. So
right.
What I mean by that is not necessarily the makeup of the athlete or that football is a superior sport or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But just in a way where I was knew I was going to be challenged to my max.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I could be challenged in that way, in that environment, then I knew I could swim in any other environment.
Sure.
How did you like, you know, you go in there as a 19-year-old having nothing to do with strength conditioning. How did you separate yourself with like the other interns that were around and you being a female, like coming into that environment? Like, how did you set yourself apart from everybody else?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny now having interns because you can see what it takes to be a great intern. You know, is you can tell within a week of having an intern if someone's going to be great.
He said that on our last show.
It's absolutely true. And so I look back and I was so scared in my internship of doing a good job, but that probably made me do a really good job.
Mm-hmm.
because I honestly, I just worked really hard. I just showed up on time, worked my booty off, and wanted to learn, wanted to be there. And it was a very demanding job, for sure. I'm going to call it a job, but internship is very demanding. And I think just being responsible and working my butt off.
Anna, before we started the show today, we were kind of joking around and we had like 10 minutes just to kill time. But I asked you, and I just want you to run it back for me. How many national championships have you won?
I have 7.
How many Olympic athletes have you coached?
I think it's the same number. I think it's 7.
How long have you been in your position at Texas?
About 10 years with the Olympic sports, 12 total.
So for anyone who doesn't have any perspective on that, she's a total stud. Anna is an excellent coach, and to be able to have that much success spanning different sports is really just a testament to your hard work, effort, and dedication. It's very impressive. And the reason I say all that is, and really this is twofold, and I'll start with the first question, is being a woman in this field, I don't know what it's like. Zach doesn't know what it's like. There out there somewhere is some young woman who wants to do what Anna Craig's doing right now. So if you could reach out to her and you could tell her some of the things that helped you start from that scared intern to who you are and where you are today, what would you tell that young lady?
I think being a female in our field, I don't think you need to overplay it, and I don't think that you need to underplay it. I don't know that it needs to be ignored, but I don't know that it needs to be the end all be all of I'm a female, and so I stand out and I'm unique and I have all of these extra battles to fight. You know, I think when you focus on it too much, it distracts from what the actual goal is.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say you have to attach yourself to a great person, and you have to be led by somebody that mimics what you want to be and what you want to emblaze when you get older. For me, that was Benny. I remember when I was 19 years old and I first walked into the weight room, and the first day I stood in the corner.
Can relate.
And, you know, I'm like, there's 100 guys running around. It was a team workout. I stand in the corner. And then afterwards he says, if you're just going to stand in the corner, then what are you even doing here? You know, you need to get into the mix and you need to be coaching. And he said, today is the last day that you're going to think of yourself as a female. All you are is just a coach. And that gave me the opportunity of the person at the very top didn't view me any differently. Mm-hmm. And he always gave me the right to coach someone or not coach someone. If someone disrespected me, I didn't have to take the disrespect.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody, you know, silly things, like if they didn't shower before they stretched, and I reserved the right to not stretch them out and, you know, and provide, like, stuff we're there,
yeah.
we're there to serve them, and we're there to coach them. And if they don't want to take that privilege, like, it's a privilege to be coached. Mm. And with that mindset, I never had to view myself as a female, you know, but on the other sense is I absolutely was. And there were plenty of hardships involved in that. And the irony was that the players were never the people that gave me a hard time. It was actually the coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, I think sometimes things are very lonely in that. And you do have to have just a strong conviction of what you're doing and a confidence that comes from somewhere else. And I think all of us deal with that, is at some point you're going to feel small and you're going to feel beat down. And, mm-hmm. you know, and so I think understanding that you are different and use your differences to your advantage, and don't ignore the fact that you have differences that can actually be counted as strengths. But mm-hmm. also, if it's all you focus on, then you'll start seeing yourself as different, and you'll start, I think, perhaps living into that.
What do you see as some, like, I think people focus too much on, like, what are the hard things about being a female coach? Yeah. But, like, what are the advantages in your position that you have as a female coach over, you know, a male coach?
I love that question.
Yeah.
just in general, what my experience, I'll just talk about football because that's when I was the only female, is now I have plenty of females around me all the time. But I found it like pretty easy to connect to guys. So one of the things that I did when I was a student and even in my entry level position with football is I worked with the injured players a lot. And I have, you do not get any closer to an athlete than working with them when they're injured. I mean, you can just create such a bond with them because they're in one of the hardest places. You're spending a ton of maybe one-on-one or one-on-three time with them. And I noticed that I needed to give more individual coaching, as I was never going to be the biggest person in the room that's like the big rah-rah, or I've never been a cusser or anything like that. And that's meant for kind of the head strength coach, is they're the big rah-rah person. They're the person that's creating the big energy environment, right? And where can I fill in the gaps? That's your job as an assistant and even on your coaching staff, is it's not how can you be the same person as your coach? It's where can I fill the gaps in? Mm-hmm. And for me, filling those gaps in was giving guys more individual coaching attention, or like a quieter coaching presence, not less intense, but you know, more instructional, more attentive, more let me come and help you, let me come and kind of serve you. And then, you know, just being for them, just making sure that they know that you're there to get them better. So I just tried to fill in the gaps kind of with my personality of where can I fill a different role that's not being filled.
So you went with the coaching route, not the hype woman route.
Yes.
Wow, that's a good idea, I think. I think too many people see like the stuff on ESPN where coaches are yelling and waving a towel and all that stuff, and they think that's what strength coaches are. I feel like all the time people are like, you must be the loudest, craziest person ever. And it's like, well, it's a time and place for that. But at the end of the day, like, these athletes should be able to motivate themselves to do things. And I think it's how you were saying, like, the way you can deliver that message of coaching, I'm sure, is what separates you apart from, you know, everyone else you're working with and everything.
And I think the thing, you're absolutely right, in our field is, you know, it's like the hype guy, right? The strength and conditioning coach is the hype guy. But coaching is...
You mean you don't want to rip your sleeves off?
I mean, sometimes
pre-game?
I do. Yeah. Sometimes I do, but not always. And that, you know,
I can just see you ripping your sleeves off and screaming, let's freaking go,
but like,
in someone's face.
But your point is... But that should be what you want to do in that moment. Is like, you don't have to be the hype guy if it's fake.
Right.
If you're not actually hyped. Yeah. If you're not actually hyped and you're not excited to pump your athletes up, maybe there's a time for a different personality trait. Maybe there's a moment to be quieter and more individual. Maybe there's a moment to let the team be more rah-rah. Maybe there's a moment to hype everybody up. But I know, like, the best things that you can say to your team are when you feel that way. You're like, let's freaking go.
Yeah.
Like, because I want to go, because I want you to go, not because that's what I'm like manufacturing.
Well, they know it comes at a place of like you're serious about it. And I feel like if you're always rah rah all the time, it kind of loses its effect of like, here goes Tim again screaming. Mm-hmm. But like if you're, you know, your status quo, and then one day you come out there and, you know, let's freaking go, I think there's a different message than the usual, like, let's go, guys.
Well, you kind of, you made me think of something. So, like, the idea that you don't have to be effective, the idea isn't to try and be something. It's to meet people where they're at and to show up as an authentic version of yourself. We were talking beforehand. There, in my experience, there's an undeniable link between growing as an individual, growing as a person, and being an effective communicator, and ultimately being a better coach. So on a personal level, are there life lessons you learned or overarching principles that have made you into the coach that you are?
Absolutely. I think, like, getting older, and the answer I would honestly give is like suffering. that sounds maybe bad, but I think that growth, you grow because you have to grow. Most of us want to live comfortably and we want to kind of stay at the status quo. You know, our bodies all the way down to the physical level love equilibrium and love homeostasis, right? Mm-hmm. And we're the same personality wise. Is if something's working for you, you're probably going to kind of stay that way. And when you're really, really uncomfortable, mm-hmm. is when things start to change and morph, and you start to get pushback, you know, and you say, okay, well, that's not working for me anymore. Or something goes on in your life and you go through something really, really hard and you learn compassion, or you learn how to treat people a little bit mm-hmm. differently. And so in the process of going through hard things myself, my capacity for the right amount of compassion has grown. And also learning people's capacity in that is, mm-hmm. again, coaching is not, it's not burying people, but it's also not giving things to people. Yeah. Is you have to know what your athlete's capacity is. You have to know what they're capable of. Because I go out and I have Zach run, you know, I say, Zach, you need to run a 5:30 mile. I mean, Zach's fast, but... You know, and so Zach tries and he fails, and Zach tries and he fails, and Zach tries and he fails, and I
get your shit together, Zach. Yeah, and for the love, dude.
And then what's Zach gonna do? He's gonna kind of like roll. You know, he's gonna say, "I gotta show up the next day, and I'm just gonna fail again."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so he gives up. He starts running instead of a 5:44 and a 5:40 and a 5:30, he starts running a 5:50 and a 6 and a who cares, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then on the flip side, if I go out and I tell Zach, go run a 10-minute mile, I mean, what kind of satisfaction is in that? And so I think learning the right amount of pushing your athletes, when to give compassion, when to just honestly make them keep going, make them work, is part of being a great coach. And I think that you can only really learn that through life experiences.
There's a quote. Mm-hmm. I have two quotes, actually. One, and I've recognized what you said as being true just in my professional and personal life, is suffering is the touchstone of growth. Not that, you know, necessarily seeking suffering, but that, you know, oftentimes, and then here's the second quote, I move at the speed of suffering. So until I feel so compelled to change the way I'm showing up or what I'm doing, because it's become so uncomfortable to me, historically, I won't do it, you know, unless it gets real bad or life shows up. And the shift for me has been, instead of sitting around and waiting for things to get miserable, I do a much better job today of having some foresight because of the experience I've had, and attacking maybe some of the things in my life that I'm able to recognize as character defects or ways that I'm not showing up the way that I know I could or want to, and attacking it head on as opposed to allowing it to happen. Mm-hmm. And in that way, I think you kind of sometimes have two choices. Like, you can choose to make change. You can choose to grow, or life's going to choose for you.
They say you can be better for it or bitter for it.
Mm.
You know, is going through something hard, you don't, it's not a rite of passage coming out the other end and being a better person. You have to do the process correctly.
Mm.
And, you know, what suffering is not also ends up being a gift if you go through it the right way, you know, is anything can be a gift.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to do it well, and you have to suffer well, and you have to go through the process of refining yourself. And then you get the passage of coming out of the other end, somebody that you like more, somebody that can relate to other people better, or it can, to your point, is it can destroy you. It can make you bitter. It can make you that, you know, coach that everybody hates.
Yeah.
because they're hard.
I wouldn't know anything about that. So yeah.
There's a scripture that says the outpouring of the heart is the mouth. Is like, you can't fake what's inside. Is what's inside is gonna inevitably seep out of you at the moment that you least expect.
Anna, what are some life events that have moved the needle for you and who you are as a person, that have translated to you being able to show up as a better person, as a better coach?
I would say my first hard, really, oh, well, there were a couple of things in my upbringing that were hard, but my first kind of season of things being hard was working with football as the only female. I learned a lot of lessons through that. And mm-hmm. and then my biggest life event was I lost my sister in 2018, and she had some struggles all growing up through our childhood. And so I got a firsthand seat at mm-hmm. somebody who really, really battled most of her life. And I learned an immense amount of compassion through that, because I was always the person that thought that you could just gut through things. And if you just tried hard enough, and if you were just tough enough, then you could just get through it. And no amount of toughness and no amount of battling could get her through what she went through. And then ultimately it culminated in her passing away. And so a lot of who I am is the legacy of what I got from her. And something that's really special about that for me is she didn't get this long life of being able to impact people, or even when she was alive, she had a fairly small world that she lived in. But I get to encounter hundreds of people every single day. And so part of my drive is holding her legacy and kind of what she lived for. And she was always a better person than me.
Anna, I find that hard to believe, but I believe you.
And then, yeah, recently I've also gone through an injury, which has brought me into a whole new level of learning about my athletes and learning how to relate to my athletes. So, you know.
And what a great topic. Can we tease that out?
Yeah.
Because some of the biggest lessons, we've all been injured here, okay?
The gift of injury, baby.
So, yeah, Zach got the gift.
Injured with
the gift of a ruptured Achilles working out with me and my buddy Daniel, who's also recently on the show. You know, I've broken my back playing football, shoulder surgeries, hernias, you know, jumper's knee, things that have kept me from doing the stuff I love to do. And I know you love to train. Anna, for everyone who doesn't know, she walks the walk. She's a total stud. Like, welcome to the gun show. Anna, she's an animal.
It used to be at this point, because I'm still injured.
Okay, so tell all of us, what do you learn from injury? What have you learned so far? And how has it helped you with your athletes?
What have I learned so far? That it is hard.
Yeah.
It is hard. And we have athletes. I mean, Zach and I work in the college sector. And mm-hmm. so it would be a fluke of a season if somebody didn't have some kind of somewhat major injury, right?
Yeah.
You know, an ACL or something like that. And so it's really put me in the perspective of what my athletes are going through. And it is a season where what you love most has been taken away from you. Probably your outlet for your stress, what you love, your livelihood, or, you know, for our athletes, somewhat their livelihood, you know, their passion. And it gets stripped away from you. And you don't know when it's going to be back. You don't know how you're going to feel. It's this very kind mm-hmm. of open-ended road. And it can be really lonely. It can be really isolating. It can be really uncertain. It can be physically hard. You're usually in pain. So there's a mental and physical component to it. There's a social component to it. There's a habits of daily living component to it. I mean, injury can be all-encompassing. And
yeah.
I think just learning the difficulty of that, and hopefully I get through my injury at some point. You know, there's kind of a reporting bias where it's like, I'm thankful for the hardships that I've gone through. But that's because you're happening. Over that's, the
yeah,
hardships. Exactly.
Right, yeah.
That's because you are done with
because
the hardships.
In the rear view.
Yeah. Yeah. So with it still being very much in the front windshield for me, it's really interesting. And I hope that you re-interview me a year from now and I get to tell you all the wonderful things
that you learned
about being
yes.
injured. But for right now, I'm still very much in the battle. And there's this phrase that I like to tell my athletes where you talk about dying to self.
Yeah.
And you just say, I don't feel good today. I'm hurting today. but it's not about me. You know that as a dad.
Yeah.
It's not about me. Mm-hmm. It's about the way that I project myself towards the people around me. And maybe I'm not going to be perfect, but I still have a job to do. And there's this quote that says, don't turn a dangerous season or don't turn a hard season into a dangerous season. And what I mean by that is when you have something that's hard, keep the structures in your life, keep people around you to support you, try to continue habits that make you happy, try to keep structures, don't lean in towards being a recluse, don't pull away from people, don't press into addictive habits. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to keep as much normalcy as I can and much support around me as I can as I get through it.
And can I ask you what the injury is?
Yeah, you'll have never heard of it because either had a lot of the doctors that I saw.
It's wild.
So it's called Hoffa's fat pad impingement.
Is that in your knee? The fat pad in your knee?
There's a fat pad that is underneath your knee.
Yeah.
And mine became inflamed and chronically pinched. Oh. And it is one of the most highly innervated parts of your body. And so it's pretty much this vicious cycle of once it becomes pinched, then it becomes inflamed, then it pinches more, then it inflames, then it pinches more, then inflames. And there's nothing you can do to gut it out. You can't push through it. It has been, and people deal with it for years. It is a really hard and rare condition.
So I'm guessing like, there's no real reasonable, it sounds like with stuff like that. First of all, the only reason I know about the fat pad is because of my buddy Jake Tura, who has just become a knee specialist in our field. It's been cool to watch. But was there like an initial like injury or something that you can point to? I know sometimes with stuff like that, it's kind of like.
I was training for a marathon. And so apparently it's, when it does happen, even though it's incredibly uncommon, it typically happens in females. And then it can happen in females that have somewhat high riding patellas. And so just by the volume that I was, even though I was a lacrosse player, I run tons of miles every week. I had trained for half marathons, but I had never done a full.
Yeah.
So just the mileage I was doing, I think just sent me over the edge. And then I started feeling this very, very distinct joint line pain. And it was undiagnosed for 8 or 9 months.
Oof.
And then I finally got a diagnosis, but at that point the inflammation and the problem had just revved up to incredibly high levels. But I had doctors telling me I needed to just see a psychologist, that I didn't have anything that could cause as much pain as I was in. And so if there's anyone that ends up listening to this podcast that needs some advice on anything with that subject, like I'm 100% would be honored to answer any questions. I also feel like a knee specialist at this point because nothing makes you research something like when you're dealing with a problem. 100%. So I have researched everything from bursa to plica to meniscus to fat pad to patella alta. I can tell you some things about knees now.
So what's been your biggest takeaway from like we talked about, you know, our outlet is like being physical, being active. And I like when I got hurt, like when I couldn't work out or anything, it was like, I don't know how to read. I can't write. Like, this is a tough situation. I'm not going to sit and watch Netflix. Like,
yeah, I'm not going to take up knitting.
No, God, no. Into these hands. And so like, what are different things that you did to, you know, keep your mind off the injury? And then like, what have you done to help better relate to, you know, your current athletes that, you know, they come in, tear an ACL. I know our identities are a lot with physical movement, but I can't imagine, you know, a college athlete who maybe has pro aspirations, like how they're dealing with that kind of stuff. Hopefully we're more emotionally mature than an 18-year-old. Tim, maybe not.
Not even close.
But like, what are different things that you did to help, you know, cope along the way? And then like, what advice do you help with your athletes that, you know, you're involved in the rehabilitation process, not just physically, but how do you help their mental side with everything?
Mm-hmm. I think I always tell my athletes, you know, like we're moving forward, like we're moving the bus forward. And so wherever you're at is your starting point. And maybe you're not moving very fast, but whatever you can do, we're going to do. So if you don't have a healthy knee, we're going to work your upper body or we're going to work your core. Is I think being really physically active, you still need an outlet. And so I would encourage coaches to just help their injured athletes continue to be active in any way that they can, whether it's I mean, I sat on a chair ski ergo for hours.
I was just about to ask. Like, what have you, you know, and you finished your question, but I'm interested to know what you're doing currently now to work around.
Yeah. So I think first of all is still continue some sort of physical outlet if you can. And then outside of that, you have to become a more multi-dimensional person is, you know, we tell our athletes all the time, there's a lot of irony in it because we're like, dedicate every hour of every day to your sport, but also don't put your whole identity in your sport. Diversify yourself, right?
You better be doing your sport all the time.
Yeah, but you also better be doing your sport all the time. So I think it's important. You have to have something outside of sport. And for me, that was my faith. That was my support system with my friends. I'm very close with my parents. So they kept me afloat, you know, mentally and physically. And I, with our athletes, you have to encourage them to make sure that sport is not their whole world, or else you will have an identity crisis. And maybe that's a good thing. I was actually sitting in my backyard with a friend the other day, and she was asking me about updates on my injury. And I was like, gosh, it just feels never ending. And she goes, I just want to affirm you that if you never get better, you are so much more than being physically active. She's like, you are.
Did you cry when she said that?
I didn't, but it
come on.
You can be honest, because that's very kind.
I think remembering that you are more than your sport is if you could never walk again, or if you could never do what you love again, is there more to you? And I think being reminded of that. And you asked me, you know, what do I do to keep my athletes going? So unfortunately, this last year, I had a crew of a couple of injured people at once, just kind of the perfect storm. And we formed a club. I'm not going to say the name of the club because then it will give away all the injuries. But we formed a club that was descriptive of the injuries that we were all dealing with.
Okay.
And try to make it fun. Is like, I say it's the best worst club you'll ever be in, because, you know, I like to work out with my injured athletes. I try to create some special time with them, and because they're ostracized, they're not with their team. They're typically in the training room, especially if it's in season.
They may not travel. Like,
yeah, and so you start to feel really separated from everybody else, and that's an easy way when they're in season and not as much as required from a strength and conditioning coach in season. Typically, the time that we're training is a little bit lower because the time that they're playing their sport is a little bit higher. And so I have some extra attention to give at that point. And I'll try to make fun training sessions with them. I'll try to just have real conversations with them. And that's not a forced activity. That's because I really care about what's going on with them. So I'll try to, you know, make things as fun as they can be while you're injured.
I suppose that's half the battle, just breaking up the monotony of, all right, another upper body day, another upper body day. Another upper body day.
Right.
No, that's cool. I think my biggest thing was, like, when athletes get hurt, we just think of the physical side, like how quickly we can get them back. But I think we neglect, like, the mental side of, you can't do the thing you love. You're watching everyone else that you're friends with doing the thing you love. Not really sure if you're going to be back to doing the thing you love. Like, that's a tough thing to come to grips with. Mm-hmm. I think we should switch gears, though. I got some good stuff for.
Okay, let's do it.
So you're obviously an elite level college coach. We can also
I think we can all agree on that.
It's just the tone you're
now. I like gassing people up in person. It's weird to get compliments in person. But tell us about you in the private sector. Now, I don't think a lot of collegiate coaches have ever been in the private sector, certainly aren't doing it at the same time. Like, what are some, you know, great things that you like about being in the private sector and juggling that with, you know, being elite level at the collegiate side?
So I originally, I mentioned at the beginning that I also work for a performance club called Collective, and I do have private clients. I teach a class there twice a week. And the thing that got me started is, we're talking about former athletes and injured athletes, is the founder of Collective was a former athlete of mine, and I worked with him through an injury. And so I came and checked out the gym, you know, 10 years after I worked with him. We had kept in touch because I said, you get really close with your injured athletes. So I kept in touch with him, came and checked out the gym, and the rest is kind of history there on starting to work with Collective. So
time out. I want some credit. Okay.
Oh, you did. Yes.
Now here's I'm gonna interject. Okay.
He deserved.
Me and Anna had met, and I said, I'm working at this gym, Collective, you need to work there. And she was a skeptic at first, but I showered her with praise and told her how awesome she was.
Did you have the mustache then?
I didn't have a mustache then. I probably was less believable. Yeah. I feel like people trust me more.
Absolutely.
With this mustache. I feel like when it's gone, I don't look like I'm old enough to make decisions for myself.
No, definitely not.
But that I just wanted to slide that in.
You do. You absolutely. You know how I said I need to think quicker on podcasts? I want to give you the credit
me
where
my flowers, go. As the young people say.
So Tim and I were friends, and it probably the real genesis of it was that you invited me to play spike ball.
I did.
With two other coworkers at Collective.
Yes, I did.
And it was so fun. They're so down to earth, and I loved the people and felt like not only like are you guys excellent coaches and competent, but also just like really cool people. And if you have never been in the strength and conditioning or private training world, there's a lot of egos.
Yeah.
And at Collective, people were just very down to earth and but trained at a high level. So that for sure was something that was very sent me over the edge. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome, Anna.
But okay, the original question was, how did it happen? How do I
juggle both? And cool things you can take away where you use stuff at Texas and Collective. And
yeah, so I had been at Texas a long time. I mean, I told you over, 10, 12 years. And I was just ready to kind of scratch a new itch. I absolutely love training college athletes, so I was not ready by any means to abandon that. But I wanted to be challenged in a little bit different way. And I kind of had always wanted a side hustle a little bit. Mm-hmm. So when that opportunity came up, I thought, oh, this is perfect. And I love it. I mean, I teach a class in the mornings and I call them my athletes in training because I treat them like a little team. And there's so much accountability there. They love training hard. I legitimately train them like a sports team. So start with
I've been to two classes and she
love
legit
her.
Runs it like the soccer team, whatever. She's in there. She's like, has them set up their equipment, lets them know what they're doing, the reason why. Like, people are on the hop. I was like, all right, here we freaking go.
Oh,
I just had
it
to fall in line.
No, I've seen it. I've never been to the class, but just it's like a cult following that Anna has.
People, yeah.
The people at Collective love Anna Craig.
They're so great.
If you're willing to get up at 6 a.m. and train a couple times a week, like you're obviously doing something good if people are coming back at that time. Like, sure, if you got a class at noon or whatever, that's an easy one to make. But if you're getting up every day at 4:30 or 5 that's to true. Come train, like, there's some value there.
There that's is a saying. Lot of value there.
But I would say, kind of circling back on some of my points earlier, is some of the pillars of my training, and I think the way that you can, I love them because they're like a little team, but you have to. I hate like giving myself credit for things, but I'm just going to give a little bit of my philosophy on how to do this kind of stuff. But there's three portions of intrinsic motivation. So in order to get your butt up and train every day at 6 a.m. is you kind of have to feel some sort of pull in doing so, right? Mm-hmm. And number one is community, is relatedness is actually the term for it in intrinsic motivation. So having the people around you that are getting you going, feeling like you're a part of something. Number two is autonomy. So feeling like you do have some sort of level of choice and you are an individual still within that setting. And then competency. So the right amount of pushing, right? Is nobody wants a lot of classes like bury you. And I think people like that for a while, but I don't think it's sustainable.
Yep.
And so I think that you have to find as a coach, not just a trainer, because I think there's a difference between the two, is you have to find the right amount of challenging people. And if you have that and you have the relatedness component, I think that people will keep coming back and want to be a part of something.
Can you imagine signing up for a gym membership? And you're like, God, the only class time I can do is 6 a.m.
Who's
oh, they have Craig? One. Anna, okay, I wonder if she knows what she's doing. And she's won 6 national championships and trains Olympians. And then you walk up in the class, you're like, oh, I wonder if this is going to be a good class. And she's got you literally setting stuff up and on a whistle, like moving.
Yeah. I'm not on a whistle.
Yeah, I may or may not be a whistle.
I haven't had a whistle in years.
No, it's high level. And like,
cannot confirm
the athletes
deny
the whistle. I'm going to call them athletes. athletes, athletes that take your class.
Yeah.
One of them covers our game. He'd be like, oh man, Anna had us doing split squats.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And pushing sleds. We did this med ball thing.
I just like, do with them. What I had them do a diving tumbling warm up one time. Oh, they're like, can we do that again? Yeah. I'm having them do like forward rolls and cartwheels. And they loved it.
So train like an Olympian with Anna Craig. It needs to be your tagline.
Yes. Maybe that's what we'll title this show.
Train like an Olympian,
like Anna Craig.
But you kind of asked me on balancing the two. So in other words, it's not that different, I guess, is what I'm kind of trying to say, is everybody thinks that training athletes versus training the general population is just like, oh, you train athletes or you train general population. There is no crossover between the two of those. I think that is completely incorrect. I think that if you know physiology, you can cater it towards the individual needs of the person. And then if you know people, you're going to coach people. You're never really just a trainer, especially if you're an excellent personal trainer, you're a coach. And so you're doing the emotional portion of things, you're doing the motivation. And I think that if you can be great at one of those, there's a lot of crossover between the two. I would say that the hardest thing would probably be going from the number of people that you're training. So when you're in the coaching public or the college sector, is you're used to commanding large groups of people. Going to an individual is a bit more foreign. And then probably the other way around is being used to training individuals, going to a much larger, large group setting is probably the thing that crosses over the least, but the physiology is there.
What would you say? Like, I know a lot of collegiate strength and conditioning coaches look down upon like private sector coaches.
Totally.
They think, I have this logo. I know more than you. I work at a big name school. The private sector guy doesn't know quite as much as me. What are some things, and we know that's not true. What are some things you've picked up from the different coaches that you worked with in the private sector, especially at Collective, of things you may have not have thought about for, you know, your niche and some of the great people you work with?
Oh, I mean, it's been great and just opening up my eyes to different styles of training. So we have a trainer at the gym that works specifically with like a new fit and muscle activation. And I've learned a lot from her on just how you can utilize electric stimulation within training. I mean, Tim, a ton on like performance training within smaller group and more of like the private setting, is he trains his athletes with French contrast methods and plyometrics. And, you know, he's doing all the things that we're doing in the college sector, but with these high level, like private. And so it's cool to see that in the smaller setting. And then we have a coach also that loves he's like the landmine kettlebell guy, you know, the metabolic conditioning. I've learned a lot of interesting things about kettlebell movements, landmine movements. And so I've learned a ton. I think it's really silly to think that there's not things to offer in both settings. Is fine. I mean, close yourself off to that. It's just more information for me to soak up from people, you know.
What's the private sector taught you on how to be a better coach? Like, what things have you learned from the private sector that maybe can help set you apart in the collegiate realm?
Working around injury probably is when you work with an older population, and I'm going to say older is like above 30.
And we are
relative to the college crowd.
Yes.
For anyone out there,
you start to have like, oh, I have that weird shoulder thing that I started dealing with. They're like, you know, I hurt my back wakeboarding 15 years ago and now it's starting to creep up. Is there's a lot more modifications that you have to do. And and this person is individually training you or individually paying you to train them the absolute best that you can for their capabilities.
Yeah.
And so learning modifications, learning how to progress people that have different injuries than what I typically encounter, you know, more chronic injuries versus acute injuries, which is what you usually deal with athletes in college. So I've learned a lot about how to use different training styles.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I jokingly say this, but I'm not really joking. It's like, if you can teach an 80-year-old woman who's never worked out how to hinge, you can do anything, you know, or an 80-year-old anybody for that matter. But to your point, like, I've always been private sector. I've never worked in the collegiate setting. And, you know, I started working with only Gen Pop, and I was just taking any athlete that I could get, you know. But I just think about some of the parallels where it was like, there are so many things I learned about having no choice, but to get really creative to meet a plethora of people where they're at. And then being then introduced into athletes. Whereas like, I feel like your journey has kind of been like the opposite of that, where it's like you've been like your internship was with Benny freaking Wiley at a really good football program. And then now it's kind of come full circle back the other way, where now you have one foot in and one foot out of both worlds. What are the pros and cons? And let's start with the collegiate realm, because that's like where you've spent the most time. What would you say to someone who's trying to figure this training thing out and they don't know which route they want to go? Because the irony is like a lot of times people in private sector, they're like, man, I wish I was over in the... And then it's funny if you talk to coaches who have been...
Done it long enough.
They're like, dudes, yeah. I got to get over to private sector. So it's funny. It's like the grass is always greener. So, you know, with your experience being as unique as it is, what are some of the pros and cons to being in the collegiate setting? And then what are some of the pros and cons to being in the private setting?
Mm. Collegiate setting is you're working with groups of high level athletes and you get to work with a team. Is I think it is very fun to work with a group of people to work on the true coaching aspect, right? As you're conducting groups, you're working on the psychology of it, you're motivating. And then, as I said, you're working with high-level athletes. So that's a blast. And then on the flip side, in the private sector, you get a more flexible schedule.
Yep.
You are getting paid more per hour.
True. Which is honestly, can I just side note, as someone who has been in the private sector for a while, that is astonishing to me. That
you absolutely are.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's money in men's basketball, football, and then scattered here and there in other positions. You know, if you're looking for a director position or something like that. But you really do have to have a passion for coaching and a love for coaching to kind of make it by in some of your early years of collegiate coaching, as your entry-level salary is typically not enough to really fund any kind of
lifestyle. Yeah, it's bad.
It's like anywhere from 25 to hopefully, like my first job, it was $30,000 mm-hmm. I was the director and I did men's, women's basketball and volleyball. So like... I was making more at that time in college, getting paid hourly as an intern and then bartending. And I took a pay cut to take my first job, which is nuts.
So I think there's massive pros and massive cons to each. And I think that sometimes you need different problems. Like every single field has problems.
100%.
But every now and then, like you get tired of your problems. And so I think when people are in the public sector and they're like, oh, man, look at the private sector. When people in the private sector are like, oh, man, look at the public sector. It's because you're just really tired of your problems. And when you go to the other sector, you're going to get problems.
New problems.
Yeah. New ones.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I am fortunate that I get to have a little bit of both of those. And so it does kind of keep the problems in both fields at bay a little bit for me. Is I get to supplement my salary. I get to scratch a different itch, be challenged in a different way. You have a lot of autonomy in the way that you're training your private clients, is you are totally in control. In the college setting, you are restricted by all kinds of things. Is you are planning around practices, you're planning around schedules, you're planning around coaching philosophies of people that you might not agree with.
Yep.
You know, maybe Zach's my head coach and he's obsessed with back squatting and I disagree with back squatting, you know?
Right.
And so there's all kinds of things that you need to be collaborative on, and there's pros and cons to that.
Can we, that's a really integral part of becoming a great coach, is being forced to work with and around other coaches or other interested parties. And my experience with that has been, I would say most coaches who are in my position in the private sector have been in the collegiate realm at some point or professional realm at some point, whereas I wasn't. I was constantly interning and putting myself in positions to try and learn from people who were doing what I'm doing today. And as a byproduct of that, I've got to work alongside and play a role in combine preps, NFL off seasons, these things that where there are more athletes, I'm working with other coaches and I'm having to make the choice and the decision to show up and be a team player and do my part, even if I don't necessarily agree with some of the things that are happening in other areas of the program, or maybe we're dealing with some egos, you know? So can you talk about that a little bit, about working with other people and navigating the space where you have to compromise and you have to meet other coaches and other people where they're at?
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Zach chime in on this too, but it's you have to be adaptable. You know, you can't have an ego that it's your way is the only way. And it probably makes you a better coach, because it's absolutely true that your way is not the only way. Is if I, you know, if Zach tells me that the only way I could possibly get my athletes stronger is to back squat them, well, that's not true. There's 20 other exercises I can do to train those exact same muscle groups, or split them up in creative ways, or, you know. And so it's about, when in college coaching, it's about looking at what the end goal is and what the bigger picture is. And your head coach, it is their program. They are accountable for the program. They are accountable for the wins and losses, and it's your job to support them and to fill in where their needs are. Mm. And so you will never agree with everything that anybody else has. Like, you know, I 100%. Mean, you've been in a relationship before. It's like, yep. You've had parents, you've had you never agree with every single thing that somebody else believes. And so I think it's being supportive, realizing that we're all driving the bus in the same direction, and doing the best that you can. Is it's never going to be Disney World, but there's ways that you can accomplish what the end goal is, no matter what your obstacles are.
Yeah, I think it's tough because you need to put yourself in that head coach's shoes. So like, if you're the head coach and you're making $3 million a year to win this many games, like, I bet you'd be micromanaging everybody, especially, let's say I got a new strength coach and I don't really know, like, are they good? Are they bad? Are the things they're saying isn't, I'm not used to the same things that my old strength coach was saying. Like, is this stuff true? So I get why. And a lot of these coaches, especially when we were younger, they've been coaching longer than we've been alive. So if Anna comes to my office at 24 telling me, you know, our conditioning test is stupid, and I've done the conditioning test for 30 years and I've won this many games, like, why would I take her advice day one?
Right.
And so it's like, what little battles am I willing to, you know, show some grace, and maybe they can win that battle. And then there's stuff where, like, you know, you pick things that you want to stand by, but also know the time that of, like, it's your team. If you want to do a marathon as our conditioning test, like, let's get ready to run it. But I think it's, you know, a collaboration with both. But a lot of it's like, I know for me when I was younger, it was like getting rid of my ego, and maybe I don't have all the answers. So yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, of knowing what to battle and then be adaptive. If you're not adaptive, like, good luck.
Mm-hmm. You know, you touched on a topic and a truth that I've kind of uncovered. And that's, training works. People can have other influence and people can do things differently. And in fact, most coaches don't do anything like every other coach. And people get really, really good results still. So it begs the question to think, you know, like, it, you know, there is no best way to get something done. That being said, Anna, what, when you look at training as a whole, what are some of the things that you like to prioritize? What are things that are important to you? And how do you bring everything together?
Mm-hmm. I, with my teams, or maybe even with my private clients, is I like to look at where I want to get to. So I like to look at the destination. So in the college setting, you're going to look at what are the demands of playing the game or the sport. And then you say, okay, well, where am I trying to get? And then where am I starting? And then the body is actually it's very smart, but it's also very dumb, right? It's you give it a stimulus and it adapts, and you give it a stimulus and it adapts. And so you say, okay, well, am I a sprinting sport? Am I a power sport? Am I, you know, what are the qualities that I need? And they're called key performance indicators. And you can really get into the weeds with them. Like, I can tell you what an elite level diver, what their vertical needs to be in order to be elite. Like, we can get into that. And so I'll work backwards and I'll say, okay, well, if you need to get to about 33, 34 inches in order to be an elite level men's diver, then, and you're starting at 29, what do we need to work on? Mm. Is we need to get you stronger. We need to get you more explosive. We need to work at rate of force development. And so then I'll build the program progressively from there. And I just look at it as, okay, what's the stimulus that I need to give in order to create the adaptation to get to the destination that I want? And that would be from a performance standpoint. From an injury standpoint, is, so I think there's kind of two different buckets of training, is there's the injury prevention, right? And then there's the performance enhancement. And so looking at the performance enhancement, that's how I kind of do things. And then I'll also say, what are the typical injuries that somebody in this sport deals with, or with my private clients, what are their pre-existing injuries? What are injuries that people kind of start to deal with as they get older? And then how can I also build in things that can help in those buckets too? And maybe they serve the same purpose, right? Is you can take a rear foot elevated split squat and you can make your legs a lot stronger doing that, but then you can also build things like foot strength, and you can, mm-hmm. You know, build strength around the knees and the BMO. And so I think that there's ways to kind of double dip on that. But I usually try and start backwards to say, what's my end goal? Where am I starting? And then how can I build the stressors and the adaptations in the middle in order to get there?
So if those are like your outputs with training, like higher verticals, getting stronger, whatnot, what inputs do you do for them to have them buy into your training, and actually what motivates them to train? And I want to go a step further. You've worked with men and women. What are the different ways that you've seen that men respond better to, women respond better to, or things that either group hates and you shouldn't do?
So you kind of mean as far as like the psychological standpoint, or more of like the physical standpoint?
Let's go psychological, just because like I think you have a great program written and everything. How do you get those athletes to be motivated to do those certain activities you want to do? Because not mm-hmm. most of these athletes, they don't come to you because they love lifting. It's usually they love soccer, tennis, or diving. So how can you make it relatable to them that they want to put in the work and do what you're asking? Mm-hmm.
First, you have to educate them. So knowing the why behind what you're doing, I think the era of the athlete just following you blindly is over. They want to know why they're doing it. They want to know what the destination is. And then we take a lot of data. And so just making that data available to them if they want to see it. So, you know, am I making progress from week to week? How is this paying off for me? So if you can show them tangible steps of you are getting better, your vertical is getting higher, you are getting stronger, that's going to inherently be a little bit more motivating for them. So I think there is an importance in taking data and giving them success along the way. It also is great feedback for your programming. So if they're not getting better,
yeah. What am I not doing?
What am I not doing? Is it my programming? Is it because I'm not motivating them very well? Mm-hmm. And then from a psychological standpoint, is people are people. And there are a lot of similarities between men and women, but there are also some unique kind of differences there. I think, first of all, working hard can be really fun. Hmm. And I want to make it fun for my athletes. It's not always fun. Sometimes I will get on them and make it less fun. But I think that there's a way to allow people to be people and have a good time, plus work hard. Like, I have this thing with my soccer team that I call Fun Fridays, and it's supposed to be ironic because it's the hardest day of the week, but working hard is fun. And there's this like bonding element to working hard, right? Mm. So first, with a group of people in general, is you need to bond them. And men kind of bond through like physical feats, right? Is usually the best athlete on a men's team is going to be the most popular guy on the team, right? He's typically going to be the leader. And you kind of need this like physical status in order to have this like social status. That is not true on a female team. Is your most talented athlete, your strongest athlete, is not necessarily your most popular athlete or your leader of the team, which can be interesting, because what happens if the leaders of your team are not the ones that are driving the work ethic, or are not the ones that are showing up on the field every single week, mm-hmm. right? So I think there's a psychological component with a female team on making sure that everybody's included in the group that everybody's going in the same direction, identifying who your leaders and who your social swingers are on the team, who are the ones that can swing the tide for better or for worse, and then creating little touch points in order to have, you know, motivational moments with them. And so, you know, one of the things I did the other week with my soccer team is it was time for a little bit of a deload with their lower body. So we did an upper body pump. Mm-hmm. And I was like,
amazing.
I was like, mandatory roll your sleeves up. Yeah. Like, we're about to like bang arms. So they start wearing their vest. Yeah. They have their sleeves pulled up, you know, and like was not a stickler on form that day.
Yeah.
Get the weight
kinda,
up.
Yeah. Just kind of get the weight up.
Swing the dumbbell curls. Doesn't matter.
And so there's a time for everything, right? Like there's a time for fun. There's a time for hard work. There's a time for, and I think from a psychological standpoint, the art of coaching is knowing when it's time to change the tune. You know, I mean, I guess that's the way that I would define that. Would you agree with that in college?
No, I agree. I think what you said, what was great was like, you have leaders and then I call it like influencers, like people that have great influence on the team and not necessarily in a good or bad way. There's just people that whatever they do, even if they're not a good player, like people are going to gravitate towards them, whether they have a good personality or they're negative. So what do you do? Like, let's say you have someone on your team that is a person of influence. Everyone likes them, all that, but they're one of your least hard workers. I feel like that's a huge obstacle that most coaches run into. Yeah.
I want them to at least be a positive person. So I think there's three people on a team. There's the people who are pulling the cart, the people in the cart, and the speed bumps, right? And do not let them be a speed bump. Mm-hmm. So it's okay if they're not the hardest worker on the team, at least like get them in the cart, right? And there's creative ways that you can do that. You can give them more individual attention, make them, you know, give them incentives along the way, make them feel like they're doing, you know, put something in there that they enjoy, that they feel successful at. Because if they're not the most talented athlete, there's probably, they want to play just like anybody else does. You know, so are they a weight room person? Are they a running person? How can you make them feel successful and highlight the area that they feel successful in? And I think you should do that with your athletes in general, is if you have an athlete that's not playing a lot of minutes, can they feel success in running? Can they feel success in lifting? And so taking that athlete and helping them create intrinsic motivation in maybe an area that doesn't associate with playing time. And then I think at some point, if you need to have a hard conversation, you have one. Is don't be afraid to be honest with an athlete and say, you know, everybody else is going in the right direction. And what's going on? Why are you not going in the same direction as everybody else? You are an influencer. You are a leader on the team. Do you understand that the direction that you go turns the tide, and for better or worse? And like giving them some responsibility for that. And giving them things that they can feel ownership over. So maybe they can't feel ownership on the team on playing time, but maybe there's a different role that you can give them. Maybe they can lead part of the warm up. Maybe they can, you know, I think that sometimes giving people more ownership can also get them on board, or giving people tasks, making them kind of your co-coaches can help them.
I like that a lot. I feel like that's usually a big issue, is the person with the most influence isn't necessarily your best player. Mm-hmm. What things have you known, like some of your best players you worked with? I know you worked with, someone that scored the PK winning kick for Team Canada.
Yeah.
What are some things, whether it's working with from football all the way to soccer now, that some of your best leaders on teams had, just besides playing ability or being strong?
Yeah, what a like great that. Question.
Some of the qualities that they had. There's kind of, this is probably not a real answer, but there's some kind of an X factor. Mm-hmm. There's a factor about every now and then you get the lightning in a bottle where your best athlete is your best leader who is also incredibly likable. And I think that the combination of those is there's some sort of selflessness about them. Mm-hmm. So there's some sort of attention to the rest of the team. There's a level of inclusiveness to them. So they make other people feel wanted, important, part of the group. They train at a high level, so they do work their butts off, and they are talented. And it is so hard to have that combination.
I feel like you get one of those like every like 5 years. And when you get one of those, you're like, this is our chance. Like, mm-hmm. it's really your biggest shot. Of any team I've worked with that have gone to a Final Four or a national championship, they had one or two men or women on their team like that. That was like, it was the hardest worker, best player, and had the best
energy. I just can't help but think of Tim Tebow.
Seriously?
I mean, though, that's literally. I know. Yes.
It's hard because, so especially there's with men, competitiveness is more outward, right? Is you and Tim want to compete with each other, you're going to go arm wrestle, or you're going to go see whose
settle
vertical is
once.
The highest. Yeah. Yeah. See whose vertical is the highest, and then you're going to feel superior. And
that's literally all our workouts are together is just us trying to outlift one another and then screaming and yelling and hyping each other up when it happens. Like that.
That's, and then you squash it, and then you walk off and you're pals and you know.
It's the best.
Yeah. And women actually have this underlying social competitiveness. So women's competitiveness is more under the surface. And I don't know if that's, there's probably something historically like physical to that, right? Is we're not as big, we're not as strong typically, we're not as fast typically. So we do rear children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, back in the caveman times, y'all are out hunting and gathering and we're like rearing children, making clothes and stuff,
yes.
right? So there's a part of us that needs to be, in order to survive, we need to be included within the social circle, right? As we need to be a part of something in order to survive. We're more communal.
Mm-hmm.
But
whereas,
then
like for me and Zach, like if I can throw a spear farther than him,
yes.
I don't care. I don't need your approval, buddy. I just took down the saber-toothed tiger. Get lost.
And then there's kind of a you know, a mate competitiveness there with women that has to be a little bit more subtle. And so all of our kind of physiological competitiveness happens in this kind of under the surface type of way, which is how women get the reputation of being like catty towards each other, mm-hmm. saying rumors, exclusive, mm-hmm. you know, we're much more catty towards one another typically. And I think it's because the level of competitiveness is this like social world of competitiveness, right?
Mm.
And I think, and that can be incredibly difficult as a coach and in commanding a group of people. And you probably even see this in your daughter's social world eventually.
Yes.
You know,
already. Absolutely. Because
it can be so hurtful and it can be so much more painful than any outward competitiveness that there is. Any outward L that you could take is typically less painful than these like inward L's. And so anything that you can do to make a group of women feel like they're moving towards the same thing and they're in it together and they're not against each other and at odds with each other, is that can work with men. That does not work well with women, is putting them at odds with one another.
Mm.
And I always say with my teams, and this is guys too, but like, don't demean me, coach me, is no one will turn on you like a demeaned and embarrassed athlete. Is no one will recluse back or go in the opposite direction of the group as someone that has felt scorned, right?
Absolutely.
And so there's a level that you with females and with leadership is it's hard because when someone starts to kind of rise to the top, is there's this level of competitiveness that kind of almost wants to bring them back down.
The crabs in the bucket deal.
Yeah.
It's so true. It's crazy.
And so to have that athlete that's that incredible leader and very, very successful and very hardworking is they need this interesting personality trait of almost like humility, fun, likability, something that brings everybody. Like, I'm not superior to you. I'm with you.
Yes.
You know? And that is, I think, unique in women's sport.
So for you, you have an interesting role because you work with the athlete more than any of the other coaches. So, you know, coaches every offseason, like, who's our leader this year? Who are we going to make our leader? What do you do to help, you know, these certain players that they want? Obviously, they want their best players to be their leaders. What are different things you do to kind of train them or give them advice on, like, how to lead? Because I think a lot of athletes inherently don't know how to lead in the correct way. It might be, you know, their tone is off. What they're saying isn't quite what their group needs to hear. Like, what different things do you do to help kind of give these athletes not only physical skills, but, you know, mental skills to become a leader?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that leaders kind of show themselves over time. I like to think of, I like to give responsibility to all my athletes. And so I call them all my co-coaches. Is I'm trying to actually coach myself out of a job, is if I can give them so much responsibility and I can make them feel like everything is so much theirs and they are responsible and accountable for everything, every single one of them. And maybe they play different roles, but I want them to all to feel like they're leaders. I want them to all feel like that they are taking just as much of a part in something as somebody else. Because that's what we say to them, right? Is, you know, that we need the last person on the bench in order to win a national championship. But like, do you mean it? Do you actually treat them that way or coach them that way? And so if you do need that person, then what role can they play? And then if your best player is not the best leader, then who's going to develop within that span and then helping them kind of develop the qualities that they have? So I think, you know, your question is kind of how do you help them? I like to see where my athletes are at. I like to see who I think fits specific roles and then how can I help enhance them within those roles? So how can I, we all love to do the things that we're good at, right? And so how can I help exaggerate the things that you're good at? And then if I need a real conversation with somebody, then I will. So Zach, you're my best player, but man, you're a turd to everybody else around you. You know, is, hey Zach, you're our best player, but you are not motivating the rest of the team. Like, I don't need you to be a speed bump. Can you at least be in the wagon? You know, can you at least be going in the direction of everybody else? How can I get you there? How can we make sure? Okay, little by little, maybe year two, Zach's like kind of on board. Okay, maybe year three, now I start to give Zach a little bit more responsibility. Maybe Zach kind of likes that responsibility, you know? So I think that there's a process to it as time goes on.
How are you able to build? Because I can sense like a tone of like, you're okay to be real with your athletes. Like, hey, this is what I see. This is an uncomfortable conversation. Like, let's have it. Besides just being there, you know, you've been the strength coach there for pretty much a decade. Like, what are some things you've done to kind of set yourself up in a position to have those real conversations with those athletes?
I think it's just them knowing I care. Mm-hmm. Like, I absolutely love my athletes and I would do almost anything for them. And you can't, I talked earlier about like, you can't fake what's inside.
That's right.
And like, I actually really, really love my athletes. And so if you're my athlete and I'm correcting you, I hope that you know it's because it comes from like a deep place of me caring about you as a human being. And I know you want to win. I know that you're here for a reason. And then also that you want to feel like a valuable member of society, right? Like you want to form into something that you're proud of. And as long as people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care, right?
Absolutely.
And so that opens the gateway to having really real conversations with people. Is if you know I care about you and then I instruct you, is you are going to assume that that comes from a place of love rather than a place of like scorn and discipline.
You know, navigating personalities and the intricacies and complexities of social structures within a team and stuff. I feel like a lot of this stuff can sometimes get pigeonholed in this idea of just being more mentally tough. And this is fresh in my mind. I saw a clip the other day on Instagram and the Colorado football team had some ex-military out to train them. And with the idea of them doing, you know, 150 pushups and carrying each other and doing lunges for 2 hours is somehow going to make them mentally tough. To be clear, armed services, those people are mentally tough, but having military come in and just bury kids for 2 hours in no way, in my opinion, teaches them what mental toughness is. It can be a fun bonding experience, but I just feel like that term in general gets thrown around so much. Anna, what is mental toughness? One, and two, how do you transmit that? What creates mental toughness for a team?
I would say mental toughness is this, a capacity to do hard things and do them in a way where you like mentally, I guess I can't use the word and the definition, use it in a way where you emotionally like push forward rather than like pulling back.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that, I talked about building competency. Is I think it's like creating a bigger gas tank, right? Is having a car with a bigger engine. Building mental strength is, and I think we can fake mental strength, right? Is, you know, people say this person is so tough, like they and maybe they grew up with trauma or something mm-hmm. that was like really difficult for them. And then you get into a mindset of, you know, maybe something else hard happens and that person actually emotionally can't handle the next thing that comes. Is there's mm-hmm. there's a point where it's too much, right? There's a point where if you don't have the system around you to help you through those things and to guide you through hard things, then I don't know if your capacity is being built or if you're just gutting it out,
mm-hmm.
right? Is you want to build capacity by feeding people something challenging, guiding them through it, supporting them through it, making it to the other side, feeling success,
mm-hmm.
and then letting them go through something else hard, right? Is it's not, it's the parent that allows their child to make mistakes and then like opens their arms up to like embrace them when it happens, problem solves with them and helps them move to the next thing, right?
Yeah.
It's not abandoning them. It's not pushing them past their capacity. And so I think that maybe some of mental toughness, instead of just kind of like creating moments of trauma for people, you know, maybe I think life gives you enough things that you need to be tough about.
100%.
You know, like if you do things the right way, if you train sport the right way, things are hard. Training is hard. Competing is hard. Going through life is hard.
Yeah.
And so give them the appropriate dosage, support them through it, coach them through it, and build their engine to be bigger than what they thought it was before, you know? And then you get this like, you get these basically like stones of remembrance at that point, right? Is now you've built these pillars in your life as time goes on and you say, okay, I did this really hard workout and I did not think that I was going to make it, but I made it and I did it and I got through it and I succeeded. And so the next time this hard workout comes, I can do it. I can make it through it, right? And so it's building those things so that now they have this whole arsenal of experiences of when they come back to it, then they know that they have the capacity to do it. And I think that that can happen physically or emotionally, but you can't jump the...
You can't manufacture
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
You know, when you were talking earlier, you were talking about how you're talking about suffering and you were talking about how you choose to walk through that suffering ultimately is the indicator for whether or not it's going to be an asset or a setback for you, and how you're able to work through that stuff. And when I think about the idea of, you know, selectively traumatizing a team in a workout or an event in the name of mental toughness, it's really short-sighted, because I firmly believe that like the only way that mental toughness is acquired is by navigating hardships, particularly in a team setting, in this open experience of like, you don't get mentally tough from like coming up short in a fourth quarter by winning fourth quarters or making the play. You do it by, because you didn't make the play, mm-hmm. because it didn't work out. And then it's how a coach or a staff is able to help that team collectively process that in a way that's healthy and productive, and then shaping it in a way that's going to be a fuel, something that can be a driver. And that to me, you know, if I even think about my personal life, you know, as someone who has plenty of trauma, okay. And, you know, I think a lot of people, to the analogy that you use, assume that because I've seen some things and been through some stuff, that inherently means that you're tough. It's like, no, well, for most of my life, my strategy was just that I was able to completely wall off and totally be numb, but I wasn't growing. I wasn't learning any tools. I wasn't getting any better. I was just prolonging the suffering, you know? Yeah. So I love the idea of it not being something that you can manufacture. It has to be a learned process, and it has to take time. Zach.
That's the big thing. I think what you said of like building the capacity to handle stress, whether mental or physical, like it's just like working out. Like you don't get stronger in one workout. It takes years and years, days and days of consistency. And I think it comes back to handling that stress and then doing the things you don't want to do that need to be done. Like, we are talk about mental toughness all the time, but like if an athlete can't make it to class on time, like to me, that's mental toughness. You're just not willing to set your alarm 10 minutes early to grab your breakfast to get to class. So like, what are we talking about here? But in your point of helping these athletes or yourself, like build this tank, like it's not a 2-day seminar or a novelty workout here and there. It's literally putting these, you know, plans into play to do every single day.
I kind of say this thing, or I've said it to one of my teams before, of, as you know, this scene in Lion King where he's like, it's, you know, Simba runs off and then Rafiki gets him back and he looks in the pool and he's like, remember who you are.
Yeah.
And I think that coming back to like, everybody needs to come back to who they want to be and what they are. And there's something really valuable in mental toughness on remembering who you are and remembering who you want to be when things get hard. Mm-hmm. And we all waver off of that.
100%.
We're all going to veer off the road, and we need somebody to bring us back in and say, hey, no matter how long the storm lasts, no matter how hard it is, there's another side, and you can be proud of the way that you did it. Like, you can come to the other side no matter what the outcome is and get to say, I'm proud of myself for how I conducted myself. And I even have those things in my life, as I have kind of these like, who am I statements. And I say, like, I am resilient. Like, I can weather the storm, right? I am compassionate. Like, I can show people kindness and just kind of say, when all goes to hell in a handbasket, is recentering yourself and looking in your metaphorical, you know, mirage pool and saying, like, remember who you are right now. And everybody, unless every now and then you get someone who's just a horrible person. Right? They're just inherently, you're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's something a little evil in you, right?
Yeah.
But 99.9% of the population wants those things. Like, we want purpose. We want to be proud of ourselves. We want to come out of the other side, but we veer off and we lose our way. And it takes time from the people around you to recenter you and to get you going again.
I love that you made that list of things like, I'm resilient, I am compassionate. Because I think when you're making decisions, you can ask yourself, would a resilient person do this? Would a compassionate person do this? Would a high-level coach who I want to be do this decision? I think if you have a overarching theme of where you see yourself going, when you see yourself veer off, if you go back to that list, I might start doing that. Might be the best course of action. Mm-hmm. She's so good, man.
She is so,
so good.
I mean, how many national titles?
Oh my God.
All joking aside, Anna, we're coming up on time, but I just got a couple more questions for you. And
are they rapid fire?
No, they're not. They're not. but they were definitely not prepped. Okay. So, looking over your career and your life, is there anything that you would go back and alter or do sooner or do differently?
Can I just say, no, everything happens the way that it's supposed to?
That's acceptable. Yeah.
I think, you know, there's things where if I could go back, I'm like, oh, that was a really dumb decision, or that was a really hard season, or I wish I could have coached that person differently. But it probably was instrumental in my growth. And so having gone through those things and being on the other side, now I can be thankful for them in the moment. I'm sure I would give you plenty of things that I would do differently.
What's next for you?
Oh, I don't know. Life just flows. I think that if you work hard and, you know, knock on doors for opportunities, like I think you got to be checking door handles. You know, you can't be just sitting back waiting for life to come to you. But I think that if you, you know, treat people well, make genuine connections, and then continue to knock on doors, then life's just going to flow.
Yeah. Anna, where can people find you except, you know, when they're looking up national titles and Olympic gold medalist?
Probably. I don't have a high presence on social media, but probably my most presence would be Instagram. And it's Anna E. Craig. You can see some videos of, you know, some of my private things and public sector things on there.
By the way, just for everyone who's made it this far in the recording, the reason why I keep bringing that up is because Anna is such a humble person that anytime she's around, I like to give her shit about how much success she's had because it makes her so uncomfortable, and it genuinely, I get a kick out of it, but also because I think she deserves to hear it. So
thanks, Tim.
Zach, anything closing for Anna?
Thank you so much for coming on. We need to do part two.
Absolutely.
I'm fired up, ready to go. Yeah. I might have to go train or classes tomorrow morning. I might be there. I might make an appearance.
6 a.m. class with Anna.
Oh, my gosh.
All right. Well, thank you to everyone who made it this far listening. We were here with Anna Craig today. Anna, thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me.